sepsis can present in a number of different ways, and sometimes it's really difficult to recognise it.
If you know the bug, if you can guess the bug, then you can choose the drug.
Prompt treatment with antibiotics will increase the possibility that people will survive an episode of sepsis.
And what we really need is newer, better tests to identify the bacteria.
So there's the unstoppable force of sepsis, which is hitting the immovable object of antibiotic resistance.
Hello and welcome to our Paediatric Sepsis podcast series, brought to you by the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health and the team from the Great North Children's Hospital, with guest speakers from all over the country. My name is Emma Lim, and I'm a general paediatric consultant at the Great North Children's Hospital. And today I have Andrew, who I'd like to introduce you to. So I first met Andrew in a Soviet-style gilt ballroom in Ljubljana, Slovenia, not dancing, but lecturing. Dr. Andrew Reardon is a paediatric infectious disease and immunology specialist from Liverpool's Alder Hey Children's Hospital. Hello.
Hi there.
That's very brief. I thought you'd be more excited to see me, hear me.
So, what do you want me to say? Come on.
So, Andrew, as a starter, what does sepsis mean to you?
Well, to paraphrase our current Prime Minister, which at the time of recording, I have to point out, is Theresa May. Prime Ministers may go up or down in future. That we could say that sepsis means sepsis. That means it's whatever people want it to mean often. It could be a child who's unwell and they think it might be infection, or a child who's just got a fever and they're worried it might be something serious. And I've heard all sorts of things referred to as sepsis. But the current adult definitions are a life-threatening organ dysfunction caused by a dysregulated host response to infection. I'll say that again, just in case you didn't catch it, because it's not that easy to understand, is it? A life-threatening organ dysfunction caused by a dysregulated host response to infection. The lay version of that, which the Sepsis Trust put out, says that sepsis is when the body's response to infection injures its own tissues and organs.
I think that's great. The trouble I have with that is, what does it actually look like in real everyday practice?
Well, that of course is the big problem here, Emma, in that sepsis can present in a number of different ways, and sometimes it's really difficult to recognise it in the early phases. The worry is that this dysregulated immune system will lead to a severe organ dysfunction, which means a child could end up on intensive care very unwell. And trying to pick out those children where you can give them early treatment and prevent that is the nubbins here. And that's actually very difficult to do.
Absolutely. So what I want to think about is, what bugs are the bugs that give us sepsis and cause these kind of problems?
So that depends on where children are. Most children live out in the community and are previously healthy. And so the sort of germs that cause infection are the common things that cause really serious infection in children. So that Neisseria meningitidis, the meningococcus, causing overwhelming bloodstream infection or meningitis. Streptococcus pneumoniae, the pneumococcus, which can cause all sorts of chest infections. And again, overwhelming infection with that. And then Staphylococcus aureus, the thing that can just cause boils or trouble on the skin, but can cause serious bone and joint infection or overwhelming toxic shock or other things like that.
And don't forget urinary tract infections. They're always my favourite.
And of course, they're the commonest bacterial infection in children. You're quite right. So they tend to be caused by germs that we carry around in our gut, like E. coli.
And I guess if you know the bug, if you can guess the bug, then you can choose the drug. So we always make assumptions about what causes sepsis when you see a patient, and then you can choose a broad spectrum antibiotic to cover these bugs. And this is known as empirical treatment. So what kind of empirical treatments do you use out in Alderhay?
So for most children from the community who are coming into hospital and you worry this might be sepsis, then you give a third-generation cephalosporin. Many people would use ceftriaxone or cefotaxime because that covers most of those common germs that cause infection from the community.
And I think those are great choices. Two things. First of all, don't forget they are penicillin-based. So if you have a serious penicillin allergy, you can't use those. Second of all, I like ceftriaxone because it's a once-a-day drug. So if children are well, this can be given in a community setting later on.
And you can give it intramuscularly. So if you get really stuck for IV access, then you've got some way of giving it even while you're trying to secure that.
Even better. There's no reason not to like it. The point about empirical treatment is you're guessing which bug it is. And the only way you can find out which bug it is by doing some investigations before you give that antibiotic. And that's the crux of it, isn't it, Andrew?
Yes, you're right. I'm going to have to make a confession here that I did not get 100% in my trust mandatory sepsis e-learning.
I'm shocked.
The question that I was, I'm sure you are. But so was I. The question that I got wrong was a question that said that we should always take a blood culture before starting antibiotics for sepsis. And I said that you should always take a blood culture. Now, quite rightly, they said, well, sometimes you just might not be able to do that because of all that's going on. And so not delaying an antibiotic by struggling for 2 hours to get a blood culture would be the sensible thing to do. But I maintain that ideally you should always get a culture before you start the antibiotics for sepsis.
I agree. I think if you're getting access, you can almost always get a blood culture. But I also think that's true of more complicated tests. So you may want to delay getting a lumbar puncture if a child is in septic shock. But blood gives us a lot of information. So what kind of tests can look for the bugs in the blood?
So there's good old-fashioned blood cultures, which have been around for over 100 years, and which are very helpful because that will actually find the particular germ, and then we can test that germ and see which antibiotics are likely to kill it. But the drawback with that, of course, is that it takes some time to physically actually grow the germ in the lab and then to do the testing to look for antibiotic sensitivity. So you're not going to get a result for at least 24 or more hours that something's growing. And you have to wait probably 36 or 48 hours to be sure that nothing is growing from the blood culture. So you're 2 days down the line before you've got real information. So quicker methods looking for bacteria in the blood involve other tests, particularly PCR tests and molecular tests, looking for bits of DNA from bacteria. And there's one that most people will be familiar with would be the one looking for meningococcal DNA, because we often send that in children we suspect have meningococcal disease. Culture is only about 50% sensitive for meningococcal disease, but by using the PCR method, then you can pick up bits of the DNA, and there's a national service to do that. It's also very useful if, by some chance, someone has given antibiotics before you take the sample, that doesn't affect whether the PCR will be positive or not.
And I think that's really important. There are other tests that you can use. I think it's really important what you say about blood cultures. In the Euclid's recent study of children with sepsis, they showed that over 50% of children who ended up in PICU actually had negative blood cultures. And it's not because they didn't have bacteria, it's because the tests are old-fashioned. And what we really need is newer, better tests to identify the bacteria. And it's particularly difficult in children because we get small samples. One of the great pushes and campaigns from NICE, the National Institute for Healthcare and Excellence, and the Sepsis Trust, is to deliver antibiotics and sepsis within 60 minutes of diagnosis. So what's the evidence behind this?
Well, as you say, NICE are very keen on this. They say that antibiotics are the cornerstone of treatment for people with sepsis. That's because they say that prompt treatment with antibiotics will increase the possibility that people will survive an episode of sepsis. It stops the infection continuing to trigger the immune dysregulation, which is leading to the organ dysfunction. Most of the evidence for giving early antibiotics comes from adult studies, and they sort of work backwards, that they look at adults who've been admitted to an intensive care unit with septic shock, and then say, well, how soon do they get antibiotics once someone recognized they had sepsis? And those who get them within 3 hours or so of that tend to do better than those who get it later than that. And when they looked in more detail, there was one study suggesting that those who got them within an hour would do better. And so they picked this one-hour target for getting antibiotics for people who might have sepsis in the hope that they would prevent some deaths that way. There's even less evidence for children, and so they've essentially used the same one-hour window for children as well as adults just to make the guideline consistent throughout. There's some evidence, certainly, for children that giving treatment within 3 hours of recognizing sepsis probably does improve their outcome. Even more so, not just giving antibiotics, but doing other things that help in sepsis, such as giving fluid boluses and assessing all those other things, may actually improve their outcome. So antibiotics early is a good thing to do. Whether 1 hour is exactly the right time or not, nobody really knows, but it's a good thing to be aiming for.
Excellent. And I'd completely agree with you that there are some new studies looking at bundles of care. So that involves taking blood cultures, giving antibiotics, giving fluids, giving early inotropes, if needed, within 1 hour, that have shown, I think this is only in the States at the moment, a reduction in mortality in pediatric sepsis. But it's not all good, because I think that this drive to give antibiotics early has led us to use antibiotics more often. And the problem that we find is that in pediatrics, a third of all the children who come into our ED department have fever. And 75% of them get sent home straight away. And only 10% have a serious bacterial infection. And only 1% have sepsis. So do you think that this drive to give antibiotics early has led to an increase in an unnecessary use in broad spectrum antibiotics?
I'm sure that's happening around many hospitals. I think we see something similar to that. And the worry, of course, is that by using many more antibiotics, we're going to drive antibiotic resistance. I sometimes talk about these as two almost opposing forces, and we're being pushed in opposite ways by guidelines at the moment. So there's the unstoppable force of sepsis, saying you must give treatment within 60 minutes, which is hitting the immovable object of antibiotic resistance, where we're being told not to use antibiotics unless we really have to. And that's a difficult thing to square, isn't it? But I think it's more of a sort of yin and yang thing. This is two sides of the same coin. And what we're trying to do is start antibiotics early, and so we should be doing that for children we think may have sepsis. But then we should review those antibiotics at about 36 hours when the blood cultures and other cultures are available and stop them early. So start early, but stop early. And that way we're going to try and reduce the number of antibiotics and give them appropriately.
Absolutely. It's smart practice. Start early. Think about whether you need them. Stop them as soon as possible. And choose the narrowest spectrum antibiotic once you know which bug it is.
Keep in touch with exciting new developments in the Pediatrics 2040 project to develop a credible vision for the future of pediatrics at www.rcpch.ac.uk/pediatrics-2040.
Andrew, we can't talk about the use of antibiotics without mentioning resistance. So on the one hand, we need to treat all these children with potential sepsis with broad-spectrum antibiotics, and on the other, we need to limit our broad-spectrum antibiotics, like you say. Otherwise, it will promote resistance. But what actually is resistance for our listeners?
The first antibiotics we found, like penicillin, come from natural organisms like fungi, and therefore some bacteria have found out ways to naturally avoid these things. And so that's been going for a long time. So they're billions of years ahead of us in knowing how to become resistant to these substances that we use. So what tends to happen is when you give an antibiotic to people, you'll kill off all the susceptible germs and you'll leave a small number which will be naturally resistant to that particular agent. And sometimes those are rather weak and weedy things and it doesn't really matter. But sometimes those germs can then pass on that resistance to a much more virulent germ by passing on their DNA through plasmids or straight DNA exchange. And so suddenly you have a germ which is able to cause quite serious infection but would be resistant to the normal antibiotics that we use. So the more antibiotics you give someone, the more you pick out the resistant germs. The other issue, I guess, is that the places where those germs tend to hang out tend to be the places we least want them to be. So like on our intensive care unit, a neonatal intensive care unit in hospitals, because they're lovely, soggy places for these nasty germs to live. And they can then become quite resistant because they see lots of different antibiotics. So children who stay in hospital quite a long time or spend lots of time in and out of hospital may become colonized with these germs that are resistant to quite a number of the routine antibiotics we'd use.
That does bring us on really naturally to those complex cases. These children have often had antibiotics before, and they're more at risk of infection and of sepsis. And these are the scenarios where you need to think about whether your first choice of antibiotic isn't enough and whether you need to choose something different. So, Andrew, bugs and kids, which children are less able to fight off infections? Who is immunocompromised?
So there is a variety of immune deficiencies. And if you look in the immunology textbook, chapter one tends to have all the really interesting, complicated things called primary immune deficiency, which I and your colleagues in Newcastle look after. These are children who've got an inborn error of their immune system, which means it doesn't work very well. Most people don't get past chapter one, but in chapter two, you have a whole long list of much more common things which make the immune system not work called secondary immune deficiencies. And actually, they're the thing that we see almost every day on the wards. So things like organ dysfunction, so children in renal failure, heart failure, liver failure, children with nutritional deficiencies, such as, well, malnutrition is probably the commonest cause of immune problems for children in the world. Children who've had recent infections with things like chickenpox or measles means their immune system is sort of stunned for 2 or 3 weeks and doesn't work very well after that. Children with cancer. And then, of course, lots of doctors give children drugs that deliberately make their immune system not work very well. Steroids, azathioprine, cyclosporine, methotrexate, or a whole load of things called something amab, which I can never work out these days. I mean, they're deliberately making the immune system not work well because that's going to make those children better because they have some underlying inflammatory things such as inflammatory bowel disease or a rheumatological problem. But these children, therefore, are at very big risk because it's almost the perfect storm, isn't it? You have children whose immune system doesn't work very well and they're the ones who are in and out of hospital a lot and therefore become colonized with germs that are more difficult to treat.
So my question to you is, you've got this perfect storm, and I think that your first choice of antibiotics, your first line antibiotics like cephalosporins, is not enough in these children. So what kind of cover do you think these children need? What choices of antibiotics would you make for them?
So that's a really good question, and that depends a little bit on their underlying conditions. And you may know something about what germs they're colonized with and what antibiotics might be more suitable for them. So the particular categories of children you need to think about. The first group are children who are being treated for cancer, who are neutropenic, who have fever, because they have a very high risk of a bad outcome if they get a gram-negative infection with something like Pseudomonas. And so NICE would recommend that they get treated with piperacillin tazobactam as their first-line treatment for fever with neutropenia. Another group who are difficult, and I know you're particularly interested in, are children with neurodisability. they're very difficult because often they may be quite difficult to assess. They can't give you much of a history themselves, and they can be hard to examine to work out what may be going on with them, and yet they can have quite serious infection. And again, they're more likely to be colonized with some of these resistant organisms such as MRSA or Pseudomonas. And so you need antibiotics that might cover those things initially.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing that I always ask my juniors to do is to look back at old results, see what children are colonized with, see what they've had infections before with, and choose drugs appropriately.
Yeah, yeah. And always seek advice. Phoning a friend is okay. A good thing to do. So you have a microbiologist, or we have infectious disease doctors here who are, quite a lot of the calls we get are that very question. Here's a child who's got a very complicated disease, but also is colonized with quite resistant things. What's the best treatment to give for them? My answer to that is often to ask, well, what do you think is the cause of the infection? Like we talked before, could it be in the urine or the chest or in the blood? And then try and pick antibiotics that might cover those areas well, with knowing what resistance is around.
I'm just going to take us quickly on to Lyme infections. So Lyme's, there's an upside and a downside, and many of these children with complex health conditions have central venous access devices or Lyme's, which is good because it means you don't have to keep taking blood tests and stabbing them, but it's bad because it means they're at constant risk of serious deep-seated infection. So Andrew, what makes Lyme infections different from other infections, and why are they so hard to treat?
Well, having a central lining like that, I knew a microbiologist who described this as a highway for germs to get into the blood. So you're deliberately bypassing one of the first immune barriers, the skin, and allowing germs to go from the outside straight into your bloodstream. And so you can get a nasty germ somehow straight into the bloodstream and carried in. So something like Staph aureus from the skin or E. coli from the gut can get in the line and make children quite unwell. The other difficult thing is that some rather non-virulent germs, so common germs that live on the skin, can get into the line as well, and they're very good at doing that and sticking to the inside of the line. So that the germ we often have on our skin called coagulase negative staphylococci, that means all the staphylococci that aren't Staph aureus, there's about a lot of them, and I don't even know half their names, but we just lump them into one group and say, this group, because they don't cause infection normally, unless they're inside you on a prosthetic bit of material, and they're really good at sticking to plastic inside of a line, and they form this special thing over them, which the microbiologists call slime. Yeah, they really call it slime. And it's this thick stuff that stops antibiotics getting through it and killing the germs. So they're stuck inside the line, and they're really hard to get rid of. And so whilst they're not very virulent, they don't make you particularly unwell, but you're going to continue to have this infection because you find it very difficult to get rid of it. And so sometimes you end up having to take that line out because you literally can't get rid of the infection inside the line.
So in summary, always take a history. Think about the child. Are they at risk of sepsis? Are they immunocompromised? Treat them with broad-spectrum antibiotic cover. Check their old results. Take investigations. Think about, do they have a Lyme? Cover Lyme infections with things like tycoplanin or vancomycin. And Andrew, so your top three tips for bugs and drugs and sepsis. Number one. Number one seems to be a big pause.
Sorry, I'm just trying to think of two and three now. In any unwell child, you have to ask yourself, could this be sepsis? Look for the high-risk criteria, assess them, and then get advice from a senior clinical decision-maker. That's often someone of ST4 or above.
Great. Number two tip?
If you think it's sepsis, then you start antibiotics early, as soon as you can, but ideally after you've taken appropriate cultures, blood, urine, and then anything else you think that might be useful.
Great. And your last top tip?
Third tip is to try and stop the antibiotics early. Look at the cultures at 36 hours and the child, if the child is well and the cultures are negative, then you could actually be able to stop the antibiotics and therefore reduce the risk of antimicrobial resistance.
Perfect. So my take-home message is, if you don't know what to do, ring somebody like Andrew, just as I've done, because you can always ask for advice. So ring your microbiology team, ring your infectious disease team. They're always happy to hear from you.
I'm just waiting for the phone call at 3 o'clock in the morning now.
All right, Andrew, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to speak to you. Even though we actually had to record this twice over, you still sound fresh and funny. It's been a great pleasure to hear from you. So this is the end of our Pediatric Sepsis podcast, talking about drugs and bugs, from myself, Emma Lim, and from...
Andrew Reardon.
In Liverpool. See you all next time. Thank you.
The Pediatric Sepsis podcast series was brought to you by the Royal College of Pediatrics and Child Health and Medisense, with support from Health Education England.